Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. 1 John 3:20 says, if our hearts condemn us, we know that God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. And my goal is not to sound as ignorant as I know in my heart I am. We try to be informed, but there's some things. Rebecca, let me ask you this. We're talking about fetal heartbeat because fetal heartbeat happens at 16 days. All right, that's pretty impressive. But
it is.
Hasn't that baby been known from the beginning of time? Didn't God know about that baby from all of eternity?
That's what he says in his word.
So, you know, viability is in God's heart and mind. Well, you know, help me here.
The very author of life is the one who determines our worth and our value.
Thank you.
Yeah, not viability or standard. I mean, it's fascinating that we can actually see how early these things are true. What we are doing is earlier and earlier recognizing the truth that God has always held and maintained, that the most precious thing, the gift of life, God has it under control. No matter what circumstances make sense to us, that has nothing to do with, really, with the way that we see things is a limitation. But the way that God sees things and orchestrates everything, that's where we put our trust, because that's what's true. So we know that the value of life comes from the author of life, who has created every single one of us in his image from the very beginning.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time. All right. Peter Kapsner is in studio right now. He's a man who gives 110%. 90% of the time. So we'll take a short break and bring him on in just a minute. And of course, you know that walk-up music belongs to Dr. Peter Kapsner. He did not win the Publishers Clearinghouse contest again last night, so he's here in studio with me. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. It's been 47 years running. I still haven't nailed that. So 1 year I will.
So I was thinking of the Three Stooges this morning. Was there ever a script even they rejected? Come on, this is even too stupid for us.
Yeah. Well, it kind of reminds me sometimes of our early segments like this. So, yeah,
well,
no, we'll go anywhere.
That.
I love that.
Yeah. You'll take this saw and you run it over Curly's head. And he'll be annoyed for sure. And then
right.
He'll turn around and he'll hit you with a pipe wrench. And they're going, nah, it's even too stupid for us.
It's so true. I mean, just even a quick poke in the eyes and they're off and running. They could do anything. I used to love that show.
Yeah. All right, let's get into something that I found fascinating. There was a problem in, I think it was Colorado, of a man who has a violent criminal record. And now he's suing a battered women's shelter for refusing to take him in because he's claiming that he is identifying as a woman.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw some of those articles floating around, just this idea of, what are some of the unintended consequences when we make the kind of decisions we do? And it all sounds so utopian and so sophisticated and cosmopolitan to kind of play around with the gender lines the way that we've been doing. It's sort of this enlightened kind of idea. But when enlightenment smacks in the middle of real life, this is what real life begins to look like when we start making these kinds of decisions. And so for somebody they're transitioning their gender, that this is what we're going to run into.
Because he has a history of being violent and against women, and now he's trying to figure out that he belongs there because of how he identifies. And I don't know, this seems like common sense has to kick in one of these days.
Yeah, this is some of the early conversations, if we remember, some of our major retail stores were having when they were talking about allowing for gender fluid bathrooms, and however you identify on that given day would be related to the bathroom that you could choose. And of course, there was a lot of consternation and blowback about the idea that somebody who is identifying as a certain gender could suddenly show up in an environment that was otherwise gender protected. And these events, unfortunately, will continue to rise up in ways that I don't think we can anticipate fully.
Mm-hmm. Peter, let's talk a little bit about, just staying on the subject, this student from the University of Indiana University of Pennsylvania, who was barred from class because he said that there is only two genders, and he got barred from class for that by the professor.
Saw that.
Which were that?
Well, that's, you know, and again, it speaks to, and being a person who's been in academia for the past 15, 16 years of my life, there is this pressure always to come up with what's new and latest and greatest and new ideas that sort of deconstruct or reject the past. Mm-hmm. And then those ideas start coming into the classroom. And again, over the last couple of years, this is one of the main ideas I've seen being bandied around in many classrooms, where gender fluidity is sort of the established norm now. And if you don't buy into that, you're seen as kind of archaic or old-fashioned. You're certainly seen as bigoted. You don't actually see people for who they actually and really are. And there just really isn't a lot of conversation about what all goes into somebody who's experiencing a bit of gender dysphoria, where their biological sex doesn't seem to match how they perceive themselves. There's a lot of better conversations I think we could have around the psychological and sociological reasons for this, as opposed to just saying, hey, we've become more enlightened in academia now, and so you need to buy into gender fluidity or else we're going to kick you out of the classroom.
Mm-hmm. There were two people detained in the UK recently, and they were basically detained for thought crimes.
Yeah,
they hadn't done anything, but they were going to interview a conservative who was outspoken against Islam.
Yep. It reminds me of, I don't remember if you remember that old movie, Tom Cruise movie, Minority Report, where they had the police that were anticipating crimes, and they would arrest you before you actually committed the crime in anticipation of that. And I, you know, I don't want to go all Orwellian on this in 1984 Big Brother stuff, but there really is increasingly kind of this oppressive feeling that if you say or think a certain kind of way, that just even the freedom of exploring different ideas doesn't exist as much as it used to a generation ago, where if you and I, Bill, disagreed on something, we could sit across a cup of coffee and actually have some conversations about that. And increasingly, we can't. It's either I believe the way that you do, or there's going to be implications for the way that I believe. And it's polarized, isn't it?
Yeah, because if you object to their ideas, you're backwards.
Absolutely.
And they use language as a weapon. And if you don't toe the line, you are exiled.
Right.
So, it's interesting. There was another story I saw in the local paper about an LGBTQ organization. And I thought this was interesting language and words. This spokesman said, there is still work to be done in the evolving fight for culture change.
Right.
Well, wait a minute. Can Christians use those words too? Because we're in the fight for culture change. Can we come out and say that? Or will we be vilified?
Yeah, that is the double standard that exists. You absolutely identified it, is that there is a certain way of thinking that is seen as culturally appropriate and enlightened. And so that is the way we must all think. And if you don't think that way, you're backwards and bigoted. But both sides of the conversation are very exclusive in the way they approach it. You need to think the way that I think. But, you know, activism is a funny thing, and it's unique to American culture in history. To be an activist means that there has to be something wrong with the culture. And so then you must have some sort of activism against it. And it knows no end. It's like, where do we go next? If you're an activist, you always have to find another cause and another idea. And you are constantly pushing those boundaries away from what are the historical norms and culture.
Mm-hmm. All right, Peter, let me take a little break. When we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Dr. Peter Kapsner. Thanks for listening to the show this morning. It is 14 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes after the hour. Welcome back to the show. I have in studio Dr. Peter Kapsner, who is a real person with real feelings, and I must treat him that way.
Thank you for noticing, Bill. This is a highlight of my year that this just happened between us. So
yeah, I figured.
Yeah, really.
All right, you're around students a lot because you're a professor here at the University of Northwestern. You're still teaching at Bethel?
I do, yeah.
Okay,
awesome.
So let me just ask you, a lot of kids nowadays in that age range are heading away from church because they don't like what they hear going on with Christian perspective. They don't like that we're not nicer to certain groups.
Sure.
And boy, I don't, I support gay marriage. So therefore, if your church says that they're against it, I'm not going to church anymore.
Exactly.
So they're just leaving in droves.
It's very true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the common critique that I hear, and I ask my students quite often in their papers to reflect and connect whatever we're talking about in class with their church background. And the real common pattern I've seen over a decade is sort of, as you've described, this resistance to organized church, because their experience within organized church was often more businessy, and there was there wasn't a sense of community. There wasn't a sense of people who are for one another. It was a lot of people who had opinions and ideas about what the church should be, and divided in power and people against one another is too often what the story has been. And so the perceived remedy to that is that everything should just be included, and that love means that there's no sense that we could say what is right and true. And I understand it. I do sympathize with it a bit. When you've experienced the pain of conflict and strife mm-hmm. in church, then you think that the remedy becomes that we just embrace all things. And that's very much what I see among my students. There's confusion, and they know that there's truth, but they're concerned about being judgmental about it, and they certainly don't want to create strife anymore. So there's sort of this all-in community, everything belongs, a mentality that I've seen the last several years. Mm-hmm.
Can you be sincere but wrong?
Absolutely. I'm sincerely wrong quite often in my life. And I think that's the trick of, if we're not able, as we talked earlier, for you and I to just sit across the table in a trusted relationship with a cup of coffee and poke into each other's lives a mm-hmm. bit to wonder, you know, I really might sincerely believe things, but that doesn't mean that they're correct just because I sincerely believe them.
Right.
And there's this idea of, could we live in relationship where, to use the biblical phrase, iron sharpening iron, where I allow you to speak into my life and to question some of my perceptions and vice versa. That's how we grow together. Otherwise, we end up in this group think, and we only are around the people that think like us.
Mm-hmm. Recently, this week, Stephen Hawking died. He was 76. He was diagnosed with ALS when he was 21.
Yeah, what a story.
Told he would have 2 years to live, and he made it an additional 50-something. I can't do the math. But here's a quote. I want you to comment on this. I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark.
Yeah, I read
sincere
some of those comments
but
last
wrong?
Night. Yeah, sincere
Hello?
But wrong.
Yeah,
and I read some of those comments, and it was interesting because if you dive into his life a little bit more, and even the last 5 years of his life, and as staunch as he was to try to allow physics to explain the entire reality of the universe, he believed that, even though he couldn't prove that, and he was trying to drive God out of the equation in some really earnest ways. But if you get behind some of those quotes, you can hear his wrestling as well, where he had to begin to acknowledge that some of his theories were going, as brilliant as they were, they began to break down. And so, for example, last night I was reading the idea that the laws of physics don't necessarily apply to all dimensions of the universe and the cosmos. And mm-hmm. that was really confusing when your whole platform of belief is that physics can explain everything. Well, suddenly they're realizing that they can look at different galaxies and planets and see, wait, the same laws of physics of Earth don't apply over there. What do we do about that? And the whole sort of framework on which the science of physics is built is being questioned. So it's interesting to listen to him, as brilliant of a mind, and I love reading his stuff because it is really explanatory, and I'm, you know, so compelled by black holes and all of those kinds of mm-hmm. mysterious things of the universe. But even Stephen was wrestling with some of these ideas and platforms that he had based his life on.
Mm-hmm. I know that we care what people think about us. Does that seem to be better or worse with social media?
Oh, well, I I know.
We just get jaded and go, I don't even care what people think about me anymore. Do we care more about that or less?
Yeah, I think what it does is it heightens my own interior insecurities. And I think so many of us have insecurities if we're honest about mm-hmm. ourselves in mm-hmm. life. And I think it just exacerbates it, because now you have people commenting on you or your photos or your post mm-hmm. all day long. And so I know for me, it certainly exacerbates things in terms of seeing what people might think about stuff. It's hard even when you give a sermon on a weekend, like I sometimes do. And those 5 minutes after a sermon, when people begin to come up and have this amazing freedom to comment on everything in that moment, you know, but it's a very vulnerable thing that we do when we put ourselves out in public. And social media is always putting ourselves out in public and for people to comment. So I know for me, it's not a very safe place to put myself out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mentioned 1 John 3:20 earlier in the program. If our hearts condemn us, we know that God is greater than our hearts and he knows everything. Talk a little bit about the idea of perfectionism that people struggle with. I know students in particular, they want They need the A's. They got to get the A's, don't they?
They do, for sure.
And they want to make sure they're doing their life just clockwork and perfect and everything else. And when that doesn't happen, it collapses, doesn't it?
It does. You know, and when you read that passage earlier this morning, it was the word condemn in the biblical text means the idea that you are now fixed in this place forever. You have no hope of future or change or growth or development. And so to condemn is just to fix somebody in place and time. And students often have the belief that if they don't get an A right now, that's the rest of their life. That's it. As opposed to this opportunity to learn and grow and develop. And there's a lot of, I've experienced an increasing pressure on professors to give A's for students, and especially if you combine that with their scholarship is at risk if they don't get a certain GPA. So they're living in this perfect place where everything, the idea of growth and development doesn't exist as much anymore. It's you've got to have it right out of the gate, and you have to have it exactly right at that point.
You know, I think of some of the students, they might have been, you know, the homecoming queen at their school and the best voice and the most talented violinist, and then they go to New York because they know that they have talent, and they go into the first time they enter a room with 70 other, you know, people who are as pretty and more talented and can sing better, and all of a sudden, boom, life, reality kicks in.
It does. I was a baseball player in high school and did pretty well at Wayzata back in the day, and then I had a scholarship down to Mankato State University to play baseball and got on the field, and what I experienced is just what you described. Suddenly there were 70 other players that were either faster or better hitters or better eye or stronger arms, and I didn't know what to do with myself at first. I thought I was the king of the world, and you know, with a quick ticket to the big leagues here. And it took me a long time to realize that life requires a lot of development and work, and you can't just walk into stuff. And there is a lot of hard work that needed to go into that.
What about if you hit a point in your life of you're in a season of life where you realize that maybe the marriage isn't as good as you thought it was going to be, and the job promotion hasn't shown up, and all of a sudden the kids are struggling in ways that you could never imagine because you're looking at yourself going, did I parent well or what? You know, all of this stuff starts to happen. How do you process those seasons of life?
Yeah, that's tricky.
Simple question.
Yeah,
by the way.
That's super easy.
Should we go
easy.
Back to the Stooges?
Yeah, maybe that might be better if I can poke you in the eyes quick. I never like those seasons where I begin to come up short, whether as a parent or in my profession. But hopefully over time I've learned that those can be invitations to be able to grow and mature a little bit. But my word, those are, especially when you mentioned the kids, that's the hardest thing. You know, we have five kids at home.
I know you do.
And there's seasons. I mean, as parents, there's seasons where everything is going swimmingly, and there's other seasons where it's really difficult and you begin to question everything about your parenting. And it's hard to remember that they're actual human beings, not just, you know, beings made in your image kind of thing. And so they're gonna have their journey ahead, and it's really, that's so hard to allow failure to be a teacher on some different levels without speaking to somehow now I'm a bad person who's been condemned, and that's really tricky.
Yeah, we can be awfully hard on ourselves.
Oh, boy.
And once you start down that road, I think you start to miss out on the grace that God wants to pour into your life every day.
Yeah.
And if you're not receiving that, you're probably suffering unnecessarily.
Well, and if we have a picture of God who is demanding perfection, and I think many of us do carry that picture either subtly or overtly in our lives, as opposed to a God who's for us, that isn't surprised by our faults and weaknesses. I mean, it's one of the great themes of the biblical text is all of these characters about whom we read had significant weaknesses, and God shows up and pours strength into them that then shines a light. And that's got to be the invitation. But in our culture, there is this crazy just demand for perfection, and we to live a different kind of life would be, I think, shine a lot of light for people in this world.
Yeah, Peter, you know, I think you're on spring break, aren't you?
I am. It's
so
great.
That's nice. So you have nowhere to go in a hurry right now, and Dr. Ann Bradley is going to come up next. She's going to talk a little bit about income inequality, which I think you should stick around for that conversation.
I'd love it. I always love speaking with Ann.
I'm getting paid to be here and you're not. So I think there's
free coffee,
little,
though. I'll
little
go
income
roll that
inequality
way.
Right there.
There
so,
is indeed.
Yeah. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Ann Bradley is going to be with us next in about 20 minutes to the top of the hour, but Peter Kapsner is going to stick around, so that'll be fun for me. Be back in a minute.
Then life is not the way, but every problem has an answer, and if yours you cannot find, you should talk it over to him. He'll give you peace of mind when you feel your life's too hard. With God.
It's 31 minutes after the hour. I think we're going to get some news. And then when we return, Dr. Ann Bradley will be with us alongside in studio. Dr. Peter Kapsner still with me. And so we'll be back. We're going to have a great conversation with Ann Bradley about income inequality. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. John Burke, pastor and author, he said there's nothing wrong with planning for retirement, but he also says what we should really be living for is heaven.
I have found as a pastor for the last 20 years that most Christians have a pretty pathetic view of the life to come. And as a result, we live for retirement. We can picture retirement. You know, a beautiful golf course and time with our friends and family and enjoying not having to labor for our work and all that. And so I find so many Christians will save and sacrifice and serve for retirement, but they won't live for eternity. And that really is, you know, Hebrews 11. The heroes of faith had their hearts set on a heavenly country that was to come. That's why God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he's prepared a city for them. And I think if we're truly going to be followers of Jesus, we have to pay attention to the way we think about the life to come and to realize the life to come is more real, is more concrete and tangible, more relational, more everything. All of this is just a shadow of what's to come. And when you start to read it again and again and again through the eyes of these people who claim they died, they were resuscitated, and they got a peek in, you start to actually believe it, and it changes how we live.
If you want to hear the full interview from John Burke, myfaithradio.com will have it. B-R-B-U-R-K-E, Burke with an E. We'll take a short break, and then when we come back, Dr. Ann Bradley.
Nobody goes through life without struggling. It's just not possible. So why do some parents freak out when their teen goes through hard times? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Struggling teens often present a crisis to their parents. Mom and dad might back away from their child in those moments because they feel like failures. Or they jump in and protect their teen from any hardship. My challenge to moms and dads with struggling teens is this. As your kids apply the principles you've taught them, they'll always run into trouble in the world. But that doesn't mean you've done your job poorly. In fact, it's your chance to step up and love your teen at a time they need you the most.
Learn how to navigate your child's turbulent teen years with Mark Gregson's free course. Get instant access by visiting freeparentingcourse.com.
All right, we are back. The big hand is on the 39. So in 21 minutes, I did the math for you. We are at the top of the hour. I have on our studio line Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley, and I still have in studio Dr. Peter Rathbone Kapsner. So we're excited to be having a conversation. Ann, where are you right now?
I am near Williamsburg, Virginia.
Okay.
You're... So a little bit south for me, southeast.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the point of hiring a personal trainer? They expect you to do all the work. What's with that?
Yeah, I agree. I haven't figured that out. And it's really expensive.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a racket.
It is a racket. Yes, it is. All right. Let's talk about income inequality. As always, it's a hot topic between the Republicans and the Democrats, and they think it's always going to be an ongoing problem. What is a Christian perspective on it?
As you know, this is a topic that's kind of near and dear to my heart.
I know it is.
You do. And I think, you know, both Republicans and Democrats need to think about this. As you mentioned, we first need to think about the moral undertones in the Christian perspective, but also not in an ideological way. And so I think going to Scripture first is the way to try to answer the problem. So the first thing is to say we know we're called to care for the poor. I've never been in front of a group of students or an audience and said, Does anybody disagree that Scripture tells us we need to care for the poor? And nobody ever disagrees with that. Where the disagreement comes in is, how do we think about the relationship between the rich and the poor? Are the rich making the poor poor or poorer? And that's the income inequality question. And there's a lot of talk recently that the rich can secure their riches. They can block people. They can kind of have this safe haven in their wealth and protect other, you know, kind of protect that position so that the poor can't ever climb out of poverty. Now, I will say that that is sometimes true. It depends on the society. It depends on the environment. No society is protected from this naturally. In fact, if you look at the record of human history, most governments, most elitists, most people with power have predated on others. And so I think it's a legitimate concern that we should not brush off and just say, oh, it's fine. Don't worry about it. That's mm-hmm. the wrong approach. I think the right approach is to say, we have to look across different societies and different arenas, and why are the rich wealthy? Why are the rich, what have they done? Have they earned their money by serving other people? Have they exploited their way to the top through political privilege and cronyism? And those are really what you want to look at. And so I think when we look at it that way, what we really want to ask is not what is the difference between the richest and the poorest. That's not as helpful for us to understand how people are doing. We want to know what it looks like to be poor and how do people get out of the bottom of the income distribution. And, you know, the American dream is one where, you know, you can start with nothing and you have an idea and you can make a bet on that idea and you can do really well for yourself. That's the society that we want to promote. And when we start to lose that in a place like the United States, we want to ask real questions about what is making this harder for people mm-hmm. and what is trapping the poor in their economic position. So I think it's just a more nuanced way to address the question of inequality.
And you have thought about this well, Anne. You've written an article in the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, which is TIFWE.org. We can direct our listeners to that. But also just would like to ask you about the six primary aspects of income inequality. Can you review some of those for us?
Sure. So I think one of the aspects is thinking about how the income is earned, right? So we talked about that a little bit, but how are the rich getting rich?
Mm-hmm.
I think another aspect, the flip side of that, is to look at why are people stuck in poverty? Poverty used to be kind of just your lot in life. From if you look again at the record of history, and, mm-hmm. and that's not true anymore. So I think that's another thing that we need to look at. I think we need to look at when people are poor, what does it take to get them out of poverty? And to me, this is where the church plays a role. This is where Christians can be on the front lines fighting this, because I think we tend to rush in to help people who are poor without being as thoughtful as we should be about what they need. So that's the other thing I would say, that if you want to solve this dilemma of poverty, which is what I'm advocating, I don't think we need to solve the problem of inequality per se, because that's kind of solving a symptom. We need to solve the problem, which is the problem of persistent poverty. And to me, this requires personal relationships. We can't just help people at the bottom by writing them a check and walking away. That may help them today, but people are poor for different reasons, especially if you look at a country like the United States, right? So they might be poor because of a recession and a job loss, and they need vocational training to find a new kind of type of employment, or you might be struggling with an addiction and you're poor for a very different reason. So we have to roll our sleeves up and model Jesus here, and we have to know the people we're trying to help. We also have to look at these bigger institutions in our society. What is the government doing and what are charities doing regarding income inequality? And is that actually making it worse or getting it better? So this is kind of a look at the means and the ends. You know, if our end is we want to help people, then we have to really say, are we being effective in doing that? And you and I have talked about the war on poverty, the U.S. war mm-hmm. on poverty before. It's a long-lived fight, and we've spent a lot of money, so the intentions are there. They're good. The question is, are we getting the results? And it doesn't seem that we are. If you just look at percentages, overall, you know, the money hasn't seemed to really shift people long-term into productive employment, increasing their skills, obtaining higher levels and more productive levels of education. Mm-hmm. So I think those are all things that we have to address when we're taking a look at, you know, what is the real problem. And I think, you know, lastly, I'll say cronyism. This is worse in some societies than others, of course, but it is a growing concern of mine in the United States. And I live right outside Washington, D.C., and I can tell you when you drive through, you know, down K Street, I call it lobbying alley. You know, just all these companies and firms and associations that have permanently positioned themselves close to Congress, why would they do that? They're doing that to secure privilege. And I think this really hurts the poor. So this is kind of exacerbating the worst type of income inequality, because the rich, who can hire multimillion-dollar lawyers, you know, a company like GE, right? They have a lot of extra capital. They can hire lobbyists. They can get an office on K Street and try to protect their privilege. And that's exactly what they do. You know, the mom and pop light bulb company, if there are any of those anymore, they can't do that.
Right.
So the little guy gets harmed in that type of environment.
I would agree. All right. And let me take a break. When we come back, more with Dr. Ann Bradley. It is 14 minutes until the top of the hour. Thanks for being here. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. Ann Bradley. She's the Vice President of Economic Initiatives at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. She received her Ph.D. in economics from George Mason University. Every time I speak to her, it makes me wish I paid more attention in class. I have still in studio Dr. Peter Kapsner, and during the break, he brought up an interesting question. I said, go ahead and ask Ann. So, Peter, ask Ann.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing great. The sun is shining in the studio now, and Bill's letting me with the mic for here just a minute. So, yeah, the question that I have is, you know, I've noticed that the most rapidly growing political movements in our country, it seems, are trending towards communism and socialism when you do some of the polling of the millennials and next generation. And can you speak a bit, you know, there's a sense in which communism and socialism is going to be the remedy to this income gap. But could you speak a bit in terms of historical perspective of the relative lack of success of those two kinds of ideologies for eliminating these income gaps?
Oh, what a beautiful question. I could talk about this for hours. I know Bill won't let me.
I wrote it. I wrote the question and then handed it to Peter.
So good.
Yeah, just so you know.
It's so good. I'm going to put you guys as plants in my class. It's so good. There's a long answer, but I'm going to answer it kind of briefly in two parts. One is the historical perspective, which you're absolutely right to point out. And I think we need to remind kind of the upcoming generations about this, which, and I always say this, it sounds good on paper, and that's why it's attractive. It sounds like we have these problems that, you know, anytime we're dealing with human beings, which we deal with them in government, in markets, in legal systems, that we're always dealing with human beings. So there's always error and there's always sin. And so that's kind of the fundamental question we need to ask when we're saying, well, what system is better? And I think the historical failures of socialism and communism are because we say we have these social ills, inequality, poverty, and as I said before, they're real. We don't want to dismiss them. But the question is, can we centralize power, not just political power, what communism most extremely does, but socialism as well, it centralizes economic power. And so the thought experiment is, are there smart enough people who we can put in power and say, this is how many rolls of paper towels Americans need? Right, because that's kind of a silly thing, but it's part of the problem of poverty. It's people don't have access. How many doses of penicillin do we need for everybody to have some? Nobody knows the answer to that question. And so historically, the problem with communism and socialism is twofold. It is, we have a knowledge problem. People, very smart people, ran the Soviet Union, by the way. They had lots of PhDs. They were economists. They didn't know how to set prices because prices aren't set by anyone. And so when you put people in these positions, you think you're solving an engineering problem, but you're not, because economies are not engineering problems. And so the problem is we don't know what to do. So in fact, instead of having plenty, we have less than we would have had in a market-based system. But you have another problem, which is a benevolence problem. So you're going to have to get people in those positions of economic and political power that cannot be corrupted. They are, you know, kind of immune to the groping for power. And Lord Acton said, right, you know, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And history just proves this over and over and over again. And I take my students down the road of Venezuela often, which is a tragedy, an unnecessary tragedy. This is what happens when the state takes more and more power. They start to take control of the economy, and look what happens. There's no penicillin today in Venezuela. penicillin is almost free for Americans.
Wow.
So this is the distinction. I think that's the lesson. And it can't just be a history lesson. It has to be, this is where it's being tried here and now. And this is the, these are the people who suffer. It's ordinary people. We're making everyone poor in a country like Venezuela. That's the lesson we need to drive home.
Mm. Yeah, and that's, I'm just trying to think of, if I'm in my car, though, today, and I'm a Christian, and I'm listening to this interview, and I'm thinking, okay, I want to, I have concerns for the poor. I'd like to be part of the solution. What might I do to help the poor? I'm just trying to do this on a micro level today. What can I do to help the poor?
So I'm going to offer two things. One is really tangible. There's a really good documentary out there, if people haven't seen it. It's called Poverty, Inc., Poverty, Inc. And it's a documentary that's on Netflix. It's easily accessible. And I think it really helps conceptualize some of the problems that Christians, charities, governments face when they try to help the poor. So I think that is a good start to say, this is a complex problem that requires a nuanced solution. So that's one kind of very tangible thing. But I think the other thing is to say, we can't just run in, I call it parachute help. We can't just run in and drop a lot of money or food or vaccinations and then walk away. I think we have to know the people we're trying to help. So if you're in your community and you want to help, look at the organizations that are already in your community. What are they doing? What do they need? How can you and your church fit in? The things that you're good at in your normal life, whatever gifts and talents and skills you have that make you good at your job or, you know, kind of good in other aspects, those are going to make you good in your charity. So go with your skills. You know, are you an accountant? You can help people with that. Are you a teacher? You can help people. So don't try to transform yourself and don't just think it's about money. I think it's about time and what amount of time can we commit to in the long haul and who are the most vulnerable in our society. So I would say start close, start at home, because that's going to give you good lessons about how to know people and help people. And then if God calls us, and he will call some of us to do international help, I think that's even harder because we have to go to the place, we have to get to know people. But if God calls us to do it, he'll provide a way for us to do that.
Awesome. Anne, thank you so much for being on the program. I appreciate you coming on always, and I appreciate your writing. And you can go to the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics to read more about Anne's her writing. And also thank you to Peter, who apparently asked this really brilliant question, but now he's sitting across from me with his fingers stuck in one of those little finger traps, so he's not that bright.
Even a blind squirrel finds an acorn. We know how that goes.
That's exactly right.
Have a great day, Anne. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks so much. All right, it's 4 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll wrap up the show in just a minute. Off the side of the road. That's a nice, soothing way to start the day. Little JT. And Peter, I got to tell you, Ann Bradley is so bright. She's always so willing to come on the show and teach us and help us to learn. And
phenomenal. I do. I learn so much when she starts talking about this kind of stuff related to economics. It's great.
I always ask more simpler questions like, have you ever noticed how expensive money has gotten lately?
That's way above my pay grade. I can't sort that out. Yeah.
So thanks for coming into the studio this morning. How are you spending your spring break, your time away from teaching students? And, you know, we talked earlier a little bit about adrenaline. It is a lot of work to present, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you sort of come down from that adrenaline for that week. Taking the week pause like this is really a refreshing time. So my kids are all in this Wizard of Oz performance at their church, and they've got four or five shows. So my life is going to be painting some walls a different color and going to Wizard of Oz. It's going to be a great weekend.
And then a word of support for teachers out there who do what you do every day. Just give them a little plug.
I think it isn't. My brother is a teacher in a high school of biology, and it just, you know, I hear the grind of it day in and day out from him sometimes, and it's an incredibly important profession these days, obviously, for so many reasons. And so if you got spring break right now as a teacher, it's well-deserved. Just set it all aside for a bit. It's really important.
A lot of stress that they have to go through, and thank you for teaching our kids. Thank you for listening to the show, and thank you for supporting Faith Radio. We just love having you with us, and every day we're trying to do our best. So have a great day, everyone. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.